1 Corinthians, Paul says, "For we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field. You are God's building. According to the grace of God which was given to me, as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, and another builds upon it. But let each one take heed how he builds on it, for no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ." In this podcast, we explore those who went the wrong way. We examine how it happened, why it happened, and who it happened to. But most importantly, we always ask the question, could it happen to us?
Well, Brian, welcome back. We are back on the podcast, back on the microphones, back in the shack. I don't know, all these back things. But hey, we're here today. We're going to talk about Westboro Baptist Church.
Yeah, this one ought to be fun. We kind of decided it last minute at the end of the last episode, and there's a lot to cover here, but I think it's going to take us quite a while, my friend.
Well, you know, it's a story of hatred. It's a story of misinterpreting the scriptures. It's a story of getting it wrong. It's a story of yuckiness. Yep. But in the end, there's a story, some stories of redemption, some stories of maybe there's a hope for the future.
Okay, I'm excited to hear this hope, because reading all of their stuff, there's not a lot of hope.
Well, you know, listeners, as y'all probably have figured out, Brian and I take a different approach to looking at things. Brian went and read all of their writings and stuff like that. I read very little of that. I've watched some of it. But I have...
You read the things that I sent him.
Yeah. But I have... I looked at their website a little bit and stuff. But what I have done is looked at interviews that they have done. I've looked at former and current members who have done interviews and things. There's been a couple of documentaries on this group, and TV shows and things, and I've watched those things. There's been a couple of books written about them, and I've read and or listened to a couple of books from former members of this cult.
Yeah.
And so there's quite a bit there, and so that's why you'll see the difference there a little bit. And I think there's a message of hope at the end of this. But we'll get there. Where do we want to start at?
Well, I think, you know, I really enjoyed the way that we did last month, breaking it down into three episodes instead of just one crazy long episode, right? It gave us a little bit more time to dive in a little deeper on some particular topics. So I say we follow the same pattern and hit the intro, the who is Westboro, where do they come from, where are they going?
Where did they come from?
Get into some theology and some of the social issues and go from there.
Okay.
Sound like a plan? Hopefully everyone that's listened so far liked that. A couple of people that I talked to did like it because it was easier to listen and then move on to something else for a little while. So
I like how you made it up like we planned that and we didn't just talk for 3 hours and then like, oh, maybe we need to split this up into three episodes.
Well, that's true.
But yeah, you make it sound a lot more professional than it really was. I appreciate that.
I'm trying. Oh, so let's kind of jump in here. We're talking about Westboro, right? This is a independent, scare quotes, Baptist church, right? In Topeka, isn't that right?
Topeka, Kansas. So they actually started as a church plant of Eastside Baptist Church. There in Topeka, and they decided to take their associate minister. Had been there about a year. Old Fred Phelps. Fred was a very enthusiastic minister. He was very passionate about what he did there, and they sent him over to plant Westboro Baptist Church in the Westboro neighborhood over there, and. Kind of an interesting little thing. He got a little church building / parsonage all together. So he actually lived, him and his wife lived there in the church building. And he planted this church, and within a year, he was just too radical for them. Right. And they're like, no, dog, we can't do this. And they would very much appreciate if we would be very clear that Westboro Baptist Church has not for many, 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 many years had anything to do with Eastside Baptist Church.
Right, right. Yep, they went independent, like the good Baptists that they are. They split off and said, we'll do it our way.
Sorry. Yes, and I don't think that they got a whole lot of resistance on that, or if there is, it wasn't documented that there was much resistance right. to that. He seemed to have a much more harsher teaching than what Eastside did.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's a very interesting guy. His dad was a preacher.
Mm-hmm.
And he was originally supposed to be very successful. But he decided to kind of do things his own way. He did go to college eventually, made his way through college, became a preacher. But his dad was a Presbyterian preacher?
Yes, if I remember right.
Yeah, and he became a Baptist, which was quite different. An independent Baptist at that, which is...
Right.
A lot of folks think of Southern Baptists, like I am, as being quite conservative. But the primitive Baptists, who he was kind of more associated with, which are independent / primitive, very individualistic. Their beliefs vary between each other. They're not in a big group together. Very much congregational, individual congregation thing. But very traditionally conservative. Very particular interpretations of Scripture. And that's kind of what got him started real good there was he was very particular in his interpretations of Scripture.
Yes.
Extremely so. Yeah. And so he ended up, you know, with this church there. They called him there over at Eastside. Then he ended up, you know, at Westboro and started that. But the church wasn't going so well because not only did the East Side abandon him, he really didn't have any church members.
Right. Yeah.
It was just kind of him and his little family sitting in this building, you know. And he didn't have a whole lot of other income sources, and he didn't make a very good living. So he decided to continue his education. While he was doing that, he had quite a few kids. I never did find out. Maybe you found out in some of your stuff if they believed in birth control. Or if they were just very enthusiastic about having children.
I never saw that come up. No.
Okay. They had quite a few kids, and he had quite a few grandkids. Bigger families were a thing, and
mm-hmm. That was kind of the thing in the '50s and sixties anyway.
This is true.
Was bigger families. So yeah, we have to make sure that we point out this was, you know, founded in 1955. So.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny. We keep talking about cults that came around kind of the same little 20-year period here that they started, yep. right?
Yep.
There was a religious thing happening in America. But interesting about this cult, there's very little evidence of them recruiting other people, or the group has mostly been themselves. We'll get into some other people who joined later mm-hmm. in the history, but it's been 98.5% the Phelpses.
Right.
There's some reports of some police calls and stuff back then. Fred Phelps was violent with his wife.
Mm.
For such a hateful group, this is not a surprising thing.
Right.
But one of the things that always comes up when people talk about Westboro and Fred Phelps and this time in their life, before he became a lawyer, he had his kids going door to door selling candy. Later, the candy company sued him because they weren't reporting things right or doing something right. He owed them money for the candy sales. And I see from the look on your face, you're like, well, that doesn't really surprise me, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, everyone that we've talked about so far has had issues at some level dealing with money.
Well, maybe I qualify to be a cult leader then. But just the fact he had his kids doing that. Now, again, for the time period, kids did do more work-like activities back then. But this has come up in the story a lot about his kids going door-to-door selling candy. to help support the family back then. Because, again, they weren't really, like, taking in lots of tithe money and stuff. Mm-hmm. But he eventually became a lawyer. And after he became a lawyer, very shortly after he became a lawyer, Brown versus Board of Education happened.
Right.
This was the landmark case. What a lot of people don't know is Brown versus Board of Education is Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka.
Mm-hmm.
Where basically the government said, no, you've got to integrate the schools. You can't say separate but equal. That isn't really, that's not a real thing. That's just something you racists made up. Right. You know? And you know what? We'd probably need to explain that because some of our listeners may not understand that concept. There were some people in our country at one time who thought, well, okay, we have to, by law, that white folks and black folks are the same, but we're going to make them not really the same, or we're going to educate them differently. We're going to give them, quote, separate but equal. But it was never equal. They would put black kids in one school and white kids in another school as if they were going to hurt each other or something. And right. then they would put all the money and resources into the white schools and not the black schools. And it creates a cycle of poverty where you don't educate people, then it's hard for them to break out of that cycle of poverty. It's a horrible thing we did in our country, among the many horrible things we did back then. And that we still seem to perpetrate some of that. But Fred Phelps became a lawyer not long after this. And he actually became a civil rights lawyer.
Yeah, I saw that and I was like, that just is odd.
He has won awards from civil rights groups for being a civil rights lawyer. Okay? He was very much... we didn't use the term back then, but he was very much an anti-racist. Okay.
Right. Okay.
He would represent people that other lawyers wouldn't represent, even other black lawyers back then wouldn't represent, mainly because he could.
Mm-hmm.
There was some money in it, honestly. He could take cases that would probably lose money because he had other backings with the church and stuff. But also, he seemed to not care if people hated him because of what he did.
Right.
And I think that that's an important point because it comes up later in the story. He didn't care that people hated him for something. It didn't bother him to people to talk bad to him or talk down to him or tell him he was wrong or anything. So he was quite effective as a civil rights lawyer for a little while there. As he was doing that, he was building up his law firm, the Phelps Law Firm. What'd they call that? Phelps Consolidated Law Firm or something like that?
Yeah, something. I don't know. I skipped a lot of that portion of the history.
As he was building that up, he also educated his children, and he made sure they got college degrees, and several of them got law degrees, and also became lawyers and came to work with him in the firm.
Okay.
So they were kind of building some wealth that way. So that's where the wealth foundation for the church came from, because these were all the members of the church.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing lawsuits and all these different things and just normal lawyer stuff and wills and things and some corporate stuff. And they were always a member of his church, and they were always pretty fundamentalist, pretty a little off the wall stuff, right?
Well, yeah.
But mostly kept to themselves and et cetera. But then he got into it with a court reporter.
Okay, I was just going to say, so what changed?
Well, this court reporter, well, that's the deal. I don't think much actually changed. So we associate if, he was a civil rights lawyer, he must be a good person. This is not necessarily the case.
No.
I could name a few current civil rights lawyers who would like to get themselves on the news that maybe did some great things back in 1968, but now are just useless, right?
Right, yep.
Mm-hmm. But... what happened was he got into this court reporter, some lawsuit or case was going on, and he asked for the documents from her and she didn't get them to him fast enough. And he felt like it caused him to lose his case. So he publicly berated her in front of everybody, hollered and screamed at her, called her names. Then he took her to court, got her up on the stand, literally called her names that I won't repeat because it would get us marked explicit on Apple.
Right.
But very derogatory names, very unprofessional. He attacked her for being, I'm trying to think of ways to say it to not get us banned. He attacked her for being very unladylike, and things like that. That really had nothing to do with the law or what was happening, but using his religious beliefs to call her down.
Okay.
He did this in front of the judge, in front of the court, in front of everybody. Because of this, he lost his right to practice law in the state of Kansas.
Okay.
Very significantly, he did not lose his right to practice law in federal court at that time. That came later, a few years later. But for a while, he could practice law, not in the state of Kansas, but he could in federal court.
Federally, right.
Later on, they had some things they didn't handle right. And two of his kids lost their right to practice temporarily. They were temporarily suspended, but got him back. So what changed? So do you want to talk about Gage Park?
Well, I don't really know. You know, like you said at the beginning, this month I spent a lot more time digging into their teachings, right? Because of the fact that they're still a active group within the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the history, you know, you've got a lot more of the history knowledge than I have.
Okay, well, let me tell you about Gage Park. So,
yeah, I mean, I've got it written down. I don't know all the details behind it.
Okay. So basically, he was taking one of his grandkids. I should mention, he was kind of into fitness. Like, he would require his kids to go run miles a day. Miles a day.
Okay.
And he was taking one of his grandkids. So at this point, he's become a grandfather. From the tales from his grandkids, he was very well liked as a grandfather. His kids have indicated, or the grandkids, through stories they heard from their parents, have indicated that he was pretty violent as a father. But as a grandfather, there's no real stories of violence and stuff like this. There's stories of him being a very loving grandfather, or maybe not loving, a very loved grandfather.
Right.
And in
right.
some cases, very loving. They really wanted to respect him. They really wanted to hold up to his standards and et cetera. And we'll get to later about when people come in and leave the group. When they leave the group, he wasn't loving, but otherwise he was.
Right. Okay.
So he was taking one of his grandkids to Gage Park, not too far from where they live. So what happened is, let me go back just a little bit. As his kids grew up, several of them, you know, they were part of his church. A few decided to leave his church, and they had a very strict rule that if you left the church, you're out. You're ostracized. They don't deal with you at all anymore. So a couple of his kids left, like at 17, 18. The ones who stayed ended up buying houses on the same block. They actually tore down all the back fences in the block. The kids live in like a suburb type area. They tore down all the back fences in the block. So all the families, all the cousins, the brothers and sisters have houses and they have kids. Mm-hmm. All the cousins share a giant backyard. How cool is that?
Right. Yeah. We shared a backyard with our neighbor, good friends. And that was always nice to have that much space to play.
Yeah. They could pull, you know, football games and baseball games, just all the space. And the church where Gramps lives, by the way, he became from Pastor Phillips to Gramps. The church where Gramps lives has a swimming pool.
Uh-huh.
And the kids were able to go swim at the swimming pool at the church at Gramps' house. So it was a big deal to be a kid there. Like, the people who grew up as children mostly say they had a good childhood. They felt mostly loved and taken care of until they got older.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so he was with one of his grandchildren. He went to Gage Park. They were riding bicycles. Gage Park back then, this was the late 70s, early 80s? Been late 80s.
91.
Right? Yeah, it's early 90s.
91 when they started there.
Gage Park was known to be a cruising spot for gay people, gay men to go cruise, looking to pick up other people and go hook up in the woods.
Right.
This is another cultural thing in our society that's happened. This is really weird, but that was a thing back then, and I think it's still a thing now for some things. I remember in my childhood, it was Burns Park in Little Rock. You always heard about Burns Park is where, around that same time, I remember hearing about that happening. Well, apparently it was Gage Park in Topeka, and he was there, and he seen some guys doing such a thing, or that he thought was doing such a thing.
Right.
And it really offended him. He believed that, you know, homosexuality was a sin, and that those people were going to go to hell. And he was really offended, and he thought he was protecting his grandson, and he went to the city council, he went to the mayor. Y'all got to do something about Gage Park. He went to the police. They're like, we know about Gage Park. We know these people are doing this, but there's nothing we can do about it. And he just really insisted they ought to be able to do something about it. Later, he even tried to run for mayor, and later even ran for governor of Kansas, trying to do something about this park and about the homosexuals.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that makes us talk about him today, right, is that he went back to his church, he called all his children, which were his church members, around, and he said, we're going to stand up for our rights. We're going to go picket at this park. And they created these horrible, horrible signs, and they went down to Gage Park. He took his little 4-year-old granddaughter down there. She wrote a book later on. It was her first time. I think she was 4 or 6, one of those ages. And all the other grandkids and his kids that were grown, and had them hanging up signs that say such horrible things. And y'all can look up these signs, but again, I don't want to get us banned on Apple, so I'm not even going to say what they said. But they talked about God hates these people. God hates that people. God hates. And they really offended people.
Mm-hmm.
They just really set people off.
Yep, and that was in 91 when they began their picketing program, right? And so they've kind of continued picketing from then forward, right?
Every day.
Mm-hmm.
Even when they continued picketing, and they did other picketing, we'll get to that in a minute, but even when they were doing other picketing things elsewhere, every day they went to Gage Park. They don't go daily anymore, but they still go weekly. If you want to go find these people, we could drive to Topeka and find them at Gage Park picketing.
Right.
Brian's got that look on his face. Hashtag road trip.
I was going to say, is that a road trip? We could record the podcast live and on the scene. It'd be great.
And you know what? If you'll look them up online, you'll see that other people have done the same with these people, because it makes good TV.
Mm-hmm.
And they know this, and that's part of the reason they're doing it.
Right.
They want the publicity. They literally teach these children how to hold 4 picket signs at once with these horrific sayings.
Yeah.
While they yell. People are so offended by the signs, they get up in these little kids' face and yell and spit on them. People are so offended, they think they're representing the Lord, they're representing someone else, that they spit on these little kids.
Right.
Granted, the little kids are spewing hatred, but they're still just little kids, man.
Right, yeah.
But it's one of these things that's so offensive that it gets the emotions going so much that people just lose their minds.
Mm-hmm.
And who's the author of Chaos, Brian?
That would be Satan. Yep.
And at every one of their pickets, you will find chaos.
Yep. Yeah, it's... Again, I might as well go ahead and get the plug in. For those of us, I think you and I could go and stand and try and actually talk to these people without having this visceral hatred reaction.
Man, I'd like to think that I could. I'd like to think that I'm mature. I'm spiritually mature enough to be able to handle such a thing. And under the right situation, maybe if I went with you, I probably could pull it off. But if I went with some other friends of ours,
I would probably go the other direction.
Because as we know, out of us two, that you're the more level one. I'd like to think I have some spiritual maturity and could pull that off, but I don't know, man. I know thyself, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
I feel like I might be one of those people who would end up getting so hyped about it until I push myself into sin.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Well, and that's exactly what that whole chaos thing's about, is you can get yourself so worked up that all of a sudden you're the sinner.
You know? Yeah, I was going to get the plug in for Man of God. You and I just finished this movie. Right, and I finally convinced you to watch it. Right, made you get on, find it on Amazon and take a look at it.
Texted me 5 times,
probably more than that. It has pr- probably become one of my favorite movies. I could see myself watching it over and over again. But, right, that's the life that we're supposed to lead as Christians, right? Saint Nectarios was unjustly punished, persecuted, hated, right? But he didn't respond with hate and offense. And so, you know, looking at these people, I would hope that I could stand in front of them, like Saint Nectarios, and pray for them, right? But, you know, as I've thought about it, it would be hard. It would be a very hard thing to do.
It would, but it is a sign of spiritual maturity.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
And, I agree, by the way. It is a great movie. I think that if it was produced a little differently, it would probably be a blockbuster, even though I don't think people would follow the concept. I think right. that produced a little differently, the story is so good that it'd be a blockbuster. But it is produced kind of a B-movie monastery type thing. Yeah, with right. a lot of closed captioning, or not, a lot of mm-hmm. subtitles. It's not all subtitles. It's mostly in English.
No. Yeah.
But, so that's, you know... But it just came out not that long ago either, so I think there's still some room for it to kind of be a cult
yeah, about a year ago
type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny that I've been looking, reading, watching about different things recently, and you wanted me to watch that movie, and I think you actually only texted me like 3 times about it. But some other things that I've been watching, reading, listening about was I've been looking up about John Wesley
mm-hmm.
and his story and his conversion experience and things. And John Wesley was a very, very I'm trying to think of the exact word. It's particular. He's very particular about his practice of his religion. Very particular yes. about doing things exactly the right way. Always looking for the right way to do things. He was a priest in the Church of England, and was very particular. Even when the church at the time was kind of had a lot of variances, he was part of a club that was very particular, which eventually became the Methodist. Mm-hmm. That yep. the Methodist is because they had a method of doing things, right?
Method of everything. Yep.
A method of everything. As a young child, he was saved from his own house burning, and people told him he was, you know, set aside by God, and he took this super serious. But after his conversion, he realized that it was not about the methods as much. It was not about, even though he never gave up his own practice of things, it was about, you know, Jesus loved us. The love of Christ was a big deal. And so he set about practicing that himself. And when he did, his ministry mm-hmm. exploded.
Yes.
Just exploded. One of the largest Christian denominations around the world at this point, you know?
Right.
Because he started following the love of Christ thing. Mm-hmm. Another thing is I've been, because y'all know that I work for a church, and there's a disclaimer at the beginning of this thing that, you know, my views here have nothing to do with the views of my church and et cetera, of my employer. But at work, our pastor asked us to read a book from Andy Stanley about not in it to win it. And it also illustrates the same concepts from the Man of God movie and from the story of John Wesley of basically, we're not here to fight. We were not called to be people. Oh, we're called to be warriors. All this war imagery is not what we were called to do. What Jesus asked us to do was love our neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And to love people like he loved people. That's what Jesus asked us to do.
Yep.
And that requires us sometimes to have the maturity to lose. So if I were to talk to these people, what my pride would want me to do is tell them how they're wrong, how Jesus said to do this,
uh-huh.
that you're wrong. But in my prideful, wanting to be so right and prove them wrong, I would actually cross myself into sin, as I mentioned earlier.
Yep.
And that's not what Jesus did. That's not what the apostles did. Reference you would use, that's not what some of the church fathers did, right?
Right.
That is not the example we're supposed to lead.
I was going to say, I don't know. St. Nicholas went and punched Arius.
They didn't all do right. David committed sins, right?
Right. Yep.
But that's what I'm saying. We're supposed to follow the example of Jesus, though.
Exactly.
Jesus,
right.
All right, when Peter pulled out the sword and cut off the ear, Jesus healed the guy.
Jesus picked it up and fixed it.
This guy, we don't know that he was a believer or a follower of Christ. There's no mention of such a thing.
Not in the Bible.
There's intentionally not a mention of such a thing. And yet, he healed him.
Yeah.
Whenever there was the woman who was being who was fixing to be stoned, and he's like, you without sin, throw the cast the first stone. He absolutely could have cast the stone. The law was pretty clear.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody in the whole world was able to cast a stone, it would have been him. But yet he chose not to.
Right.
So we're not supposed to respond with such hatred. But this group has chosen to take what they see as sin, and some of the things they think are sin, I seem to agree, and it appears to me that it is sin.
Yeah,
but that's not even the point.
Nope.
The point is how they chose to go about it, you know?
Yep.
So picketing doesn't sound like such a bad thing until you cross the line. Now you're creating chaos.
Right.
I'm not saying you should never stand up for yourself or never stand up for your rights, but they went beyond standing up for what they thought were their rights to actually tearing down other people. What's that famous saying about your freedom ends where mine begins?
Right.
You know?
Something like that.
That's not a religious concept, but it kind of applies here. That's a more of a civil mm-hmm. concept. They took pride in it. And you watch some of the interviews and the things.
Still do. Yeah.
They have, and I mentioned this in the last thing too, they have this almost this demonic thing in their eyes. They are so happy. And they're asked over and over again, why would you do this? Doesn't God say love people? And they're like, yes, this is the way we love people. See, you don't know what love is. It's love to tell them the truth. The truth is God hates them and they're going to go to hell.
Right.
And we're going to go more into that whenever we talk more about their beliefs. So we'll go back to the history part here. I think I got off of my little soapbox a little bit.
That's right. So 1998 was probably, they started picketing Gage Park in 91, but I think it was 98 that put them square in the national spotlight, where they picketed the funeral of Matthew Shepard. He was the homosexual college student from Wyoming who was murdered, and his murder was considered a hate crime.
Yeah, and very graphically tortured and murdered.
Yeah. Yep.
Like, literally
drunk.
And
they went and picketed at his funeral.
And a lot of people say they did that just for publicity. Just to get attention.
Mm-hmm.
And they agree. They did a lot of things for publicity just to get attention. They never turned down an interview.
Right.
They wanted attention from people. They were okay that when people interviewed them, they were calling them names or saying bad things about them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And we'll get into that and some of their theology stuff. But yes, that's something that they did. They were okay being the bad guy.
And something interesting about the picketing is they started traveling to picket, leaving Topeka. So, they are a cult, but some churches, some cults, maintain, control the finances of all the members and et cetera. So, most of these members of this cult have jobs at the Phillips Consolidated Law Firm. Some have jobs in other places, including some city government jobs and stuff. All the kids, when they're old enough, go and get a job. They're all, or mostly, are college educated and et cetera. They went to public schools, which I find very interesting.
Yeah.
I've read and heard that they went to public schools. They were not liked in public school.
Who would have thought?
The girls were told, and the boys, that they could not marry anybody outside the church, which makes it really hard when it's all your cousins. They did not believe in incest. They didn't do any sort of like polygamy type thing. So a lot of the girls got into teenage, you know, age and then into their 20s and realized that, you know what, we'll probably never get married. For some, that was and has been the case. For some, it hasn't been. So there's been some outsiders that have joined that have married the girls. There's something about that, too, that I think some people have possibly joined just so they can marry a girl.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some talk about some of that. They got a lot of publicity as this was happening, including some publicity from overseas, from the BBC and from different places. One of the people who joined the group in the early 2000s joined because he's seen it on a documentary in the BBC and thought, oh, I agree with some of what these people say. And then he started talking to them, and then he shows up over here, starts getting chatty with one of the girls. And of course, the only way to really get chatty with the girl is to marry her. So he ends up marrying one of the girls. And joins a cult. But where I was starting right, on this was they did not consolidate their finances. So they all tithe to the church. And a lot of them work at the law firm. So the law firm has finances up. But for like these picketing, they had to come up with their own plane tickets and their own travel accommodations.
Right.
So if they were going to go picket, and the pastor, Fred Phelps, would say, oh, we're going to go picket so-and-so. And that's the other thing. After a while, it wasn't even him saying that. It was his daughters who were running the church.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing it, which is interesting. Because in the beginning, it was his daughters. And that's going to change later. But they said, oh, we're going to go picket over here at Matthew Shepard's thing. Well, each family had to pay their own way. They had to get their own days off of work if they had a job at a different place or request off at the law firm and et cetera, and then pay their own way. I just find that interesting. Even though they all had this one big yard, that's one of the things they always refuted, that they're not a cult. Well, we have one yard because we're family. We took the fences down.
Right.
But people say, oh, that's your compound. Well, it's not a compound. It's owned separately by different people. Now, granted, mm-hmm. they helped each other when they had construction projects and adding on for rooms and things. But that's what family does, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to add on a room, you might call your dad to come over and help add on a room.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which would just make him terribly happy, but that's another story.
Absolutely, it sure would.
So, I think some of the traditional things we say as a cult, maybe they don't fit in. Or some of the traditional things that other shows would say as a cult. They fit into our stuff, and we're going to get to that.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of anything else I need to say before we move on to this one. I think that's about it if you want to move on the timeline.
Yeah, well, I mean, the next point in the timeline is 2005, where they decide to start picketing the funerals of U.S. soldiers.
Well,
which was really probably the first time that I remember hearing about them.
Right before that, it's important to note that in 2001, they came out very publicly about September 11th, when it was very big in our country that churches were coming together, houses of worship around the country of all shapes and sizes and denominations and faiths and beliefs were packed to the brim. We were a praying people on September 12th.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were a defeated people on September 11th.
Right.
And yet, Westboro came out quite publicly that God did this because of the homosexuals in the United States. And that made the news. That was a big deal. And that was a problem. And I think that's what led to this stuff later on in 2005 in the mm-hmm. Iraq war and all this.
Yeah.
As we were full on into wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, we had soldiers coming back dead. That's what's going to happen when you send our children overseas to fight over oil.
Yep.
Not that I have an opinion about that war. But as that was happening, they realized they could have even more publicity if they would show up at these funerals and protest.
Right. And not just a few of them every now and then. It was as many of them as they could possibly get to.
Yes. They were all in it. They were in it to win it.
Yep.
Some very interesting things happened around this time, though. This caused the rise of the Patriot Guard. Patriot Guard, Patriot mm-hmm. Riders. What's the name?
I don't remember.
Oh, this is important. Y'all gonna have to hear my clackety keyboard because I should have wrote that down. Because this is important.
Yeah, and Matt's getting into stuff that's not in our show notes, so.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you're good.
Patriot Guard. The Patriot Guard was formed in 2005 to shield the families of fallen heroes from those that would disrupt the service of their loved ones.
Yeah, so they were the ones that would stand between the protesters and the funeral.
The Patriot Guard riders. So what they do is they get a few hundred big, burly motorcycle people. I don't know what you call it. Big, burly bikers. There you go. A few hundred big, burly bikers. They'd roll up there. They'd strap American flags everywhere. They'd have their big old loud engines, and they'd ride up, and they would make sure the family couldn't see and couldn't hear the hateful messages the Westboro was putting out.
Yep, I remember that.
I applaud what they were trying to do.
Right.
Very notable is that the Patriot Guard riders is that they were not there to fight. They were not there to cause commotion. They were causing noise, but not commotion. They were there to make sure the family couldn't see and hear the hatefulness.
Yep.
And when interviewed, the Westboro people are like, well, don't you care about the family? Don't you care? And they're like, they're worshiping the dead anyway. You shouldn't worship their dead. They should be glad God killed their children. It just said such horrible things.
Yeah.
And so I think that's interesting because they still exist, the Patriot Guard riders. And they would actually get in between. Is this in your notes about the next part with the lawsuit? Yes.
From 2011, the Supreme Court?
Yes. Yeah. So this is where that came into play. So in 2011, there was a lawsuit. It actually made it all the way to the Supreme Court. It took a while.
Right.
That their it was their free speech rights to protest at these funerals. They won the court case. I don't completely disagree. There are a lot of people who do, though. But this isn't a free speech thing.
I mean, it's that weird space of if you reduce someone's rights in this place, where else are you going to reduce them, right? Where else is it going to land? And provided that they're not physical, right? They're not assaulting them.
Right, that's not speech then.
Right, they're not right up in their face. Right, if they're standing on the side of the road as the funeral procession goes by, you know, it is what it is. You know, as much as it's awful and filled with hate, it is.
So the ironic thing is the case that they got, they went to Supreme Court for, they were actually quite far away from the actual funeral.
Right.
The family never actually seen them there. The family was told later they were there.
Mm.
The Patriot Guard were there and were very effective, and the family never seen the protesters.
That's good.
Some people theorize that's probably part of why they won the case. Because it could not be proven the family even actually seen them.
Oh, that's a possibility.
Megan Phelps Roper, who's one of the granddaughters and a former member, mentions in her book that the family, the Phelps, the Westboro people, were happy it was this case that they got called upon because they had a better shot of winning because they didn't ever actually see the family.
Mm.
So
that emotional side of things was taken out of it. It was purely about the letter of the law.
Right. Well, and they can make arguments that, well, other people kind of brought the family into this. It wasn't the family was actually hurt by what they said. You couldn't prove that because the family didn't hear what they said. It wasn't until afterwards that other people stirred them up and had them file a lawsuit. But the family's argument was they were trying to prevent this from happening to other families. Imagine your child just got killed in war and then these people, you know?
Yeah, that would be...
Now, earlier in their picketing, let's call it protesting. There's nothing protesting. It's just picketing. Earlier in their picketing, they were picketing a restaurant that was local there in Topeka that had a manager who was gay. And they really didn't like this lady. She was, I guess, a lesbian. And they were picketing this restaurant. They did it quite often. The owner of the restaurant hired some thugs to come beat them up. And that's another thing that's mentioned in one of those books, is that you're taught to hate these people anyway. And then your aunts and uncles and cousins and your mom is out there, and they end up in the hospital because they got beat up by some thugs.
Yep. It just,
you're just going to hate them more.
Yep.
So when your grandfather and your mom tells you they're bad people, that they're evil sinners, you're going to believe this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it reminds me of Lecrae. Lecrae's a famous rapper who also identifies as Christian, because he wouldn't want us to call him a Christian rapper, which I get.
Right. Yep.
He mentions in one of his songs, he's talking about the Black Panthers. You know, we demonize the Black Panthers as some sort of almost terrorist type group, but from his perspective, they fed his family when he was a kid. You know, they helped make sure his family had food to eat, and they were trying to help his family. So from his perspective, Black Panthers weren't such a bad thing. Well, same thing for some of these children who have grown up in this. Starting with Fred Phelps's kids and then going into the grandkids. You see these interviews, and they've let the kids be interviewed as early as like 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. And the kids are spouting back this hate because that's what they're taught. I mean, we're both fathers. We know that children pick up things like crazy. We have to be careful what we say and how we do things. Because our kids will pick it up, and they don't have the other knowledge that we have, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they take one little concept and make it the whole thing. I know a lot of adults do that, too.
Right.
And so the kids were raised in this and often got a perspective of, these people hate us. They were out there. Like, they did not shield their children from any of this. They taught their children very graphic sexual things, especially about homosexuality. Had very graphic drawings on their signs and stuff, and then told them how all this, and then, and like I said, people would spit on their children. There's just so much hate begates hate begates hate begates hate.
Right, exactly.
You know?
Yep. It just keeps going. It's a circle.
So what's next on your timeline here?
2014. Fred Phelps died. And for most cults, that's the end. Not for Westboro.
Yes.
They keep on going. They're still very much active today.
Before Fred Phelps died, he was going senile. So they had a thing that if they thought you were acting in sin, they would excommunicate you from the church. They would first enact some sort of discipline, which was usually some sort of, we're not talking to you for a while, you better behave and do things right. And it was always very weird what is right, because they never were very specific about it. As Fred Phelps was getting older, and he was getting older, a group of elders took over the church. Some of these were his sons, some of these were his grandsons, and some of these very significantly were some outsiders who had joined the church. When an outsider wanted to join the church, you couldn't just show up and join. Now, anybody was welcome to come visit their church. Although you would notice the crazy right off and probably want to run screaming. But you were not necessarily allowed to join the church until you had been there for a while and they observed your lifestyle and da-da-da. So they decided to let you in, basically. But a couple of outsiders had joined the church and went all in. One guy early on had started doing a documentary on them, decided to convert and join them. And he is now currently the leader of Westboro Baptist Church.
Oh, man.
There's actually a board or a group of elders, but he's the head of the elders. Drain's his name. He joined with his wife and his daughter, daughters, and one of them is now out of the group.
Mm-hmm.
And, just completely converted into it and worked his way into a position of power. But anyways, Fred Phelps, as he was getting older, he became a little senile. And one significant thing, so I told you they all lived in kind of this block. They all live in this block there, right?
Right.
Across the street, a local LGBTQ advocacy group bought a house. And I don't remember the name of the house. I'm going to say it's called like Kindness House or something. Painted it in rainbow colors.
Yep.
Made it very clear. It's right across the street from the church.
Yep.
And does a lot of LGBTQ advocacy. They're not there just because of the church, but they are there to be a
thorn in their side.
A thorn in their side. A counterpoint to their point, you know? And it is said that as he was getting sick and he was a little senile, that Fred Phelps went out in the front yard and started hollering at them and told them they were right, that they were good people and that God loves them. Now, the church officially denies such a thing. This is rumors that have come through the grandkids. The elders went out and got him, locked him in a room, and very shortly shipped him off to a long-term care facility after this. His granddaughter was able to go to the long-term care facility, who had gotten out and was being ostracized by the rest of the group. A couple of his granddaughters actually got together and went and seen him. And he told them that he loved them and that God loves them. And seemed to have an entirely different concept than what he'd been teaching his whole life. I am looking in hope that Fred Phelps repented of his sins. I'm not sure if that's the case, and that's between him and God, honestly.
Right. Yeah.
But I pray earnestly that he did. And I hope that these rumors we've heard means that he repented of his sins and the evil that he perpetrated on this world.
Right.
But what happened was the church went more internal and less harsh. If you look at their picket signs, they are still picketing today.
Yeah.
But if you look at their picket signs, they are less harsh than they used to be. Almost every one of his kids have had children who have left the church.
Right.
Almost every one. There have been multiple, multiple grandchildren who have left the church and are no longer a part of their family. His oldest daughter, who at one time was running the church, and then when the elders took over, she was put out of power. She was disciplined from the church for being too haughty and put out of power, but not put out of the church.
Right.
Several of her kids have left. And if you look at a lot of the interviews and stuff they did, she was the media person at one time. And so you see her a lot. You see her kids a lot. And then when they come back and interview her later and she's lost 4 or 5 children, and she tells them she's lost these children. She's not, they're gone to her. And she's just heartbroken. And you can just see it in her. The power of being a mother trumps the power of the cult.
Yeah.
Almost, but not quite.
Almost. Right.
It breaks her, but she's not done. She has not left herself, you know? It is her whole life, and I don't even know if she feels like she could leave. So, yes, the church exists, but it's the shell of its former self. It's definitely in dying mode. And they do seem to sort of soften their message a little bit. Not enough to not be insane still.
Right.
But
I was going to say, I mean, I've read some of their stuff. They're still insane.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. And the worst part about it is they are insane. As we'll get into the beliefs more later, they're only a few steps further than what some of the rest of us are already, which might need to make us question that. You know?
It does. Yep.
It doesn't take too far to step out of line. And it just barrels over. We've talked about this in other cults too, right? I know we talked about it a lot with the CSA and stuff, that, you know, what seemed like a good thing, all of a sudden, you're in so deep. You know,
right.
I don't know how far that ever seemed like a good thing, but there's a lot of their core beliefs we could agree with. And then a lot that we would be like, whoa, 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 you know? So the Megan Phelps Roper wrote a book. There are several people who've written books who have left this group, but she also did a TED talk. And so TED talks get extra points.
Absolutely. Yeah.
She unfortunately
a lot easier.
Is more a humanistic person now. I think she believes in maybe a spiritual being, but not exactly. She really doesn't have firm religious beliefs anymore. because she's been so hurt by this. But what I want to bring up here, I guess it's effective to bring it up here because we're talking towards the end.
Yeah.
She left the group as a young lady, as in her mid-20s.
Okay.
She was effectively still a teenage girl because she was living at home like a teenage girl the whole time, you know? She wasn't a lawyer, but she didn't have a college degree. She helped her mom with the media stuff, and she ran the Twitter account. WBC says, I think it was. So she ran the Twitter account. She would often get in online arguments with people. She would post horrific things on Twitter just to get people to respond. But as people argued with her, she noticed that some people argued and were very hateful and blah, 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 blah. Other people tried to use logic or tried to ask her questions and really understand why she believed certain ways. And didn't condemn her personally. But explained to her, well, if you believe this, what about this? And they pointed out some of the fallacies in their beliefs, which I know you're erring to get into when we get into the beliefs, right?
Oh, of course.
You believe this, but what about this too? And pointed out some of that to her. And she had an answer for everything. But she says that those people who approached her in kindness, those people who did not approach her with hate, is what changed her. She was a staunch believer in this. She didn't believe this because, yes, she believed it because she grew up believing it, but she really believed it. You know what I'm saying? She wasn't just doing what she was told. So it was a big deal. And yet she started questioning. The egg started cracking. And eventually it completely cracked. She took her sister out with her too, who was also questioning, but maybe not as much. Her sister was a lot younger. But she'd already had other siblings who had left by this point, and since she's left, some of her other siblings have left. And they're all kind of doing different things. But she has very adamantly been against the group, and she has said she doesn't hate anybody there. She loves her family. She thinks her family, for a lot of things, treated her very well and gave her a great childhood, except for the weird religious extremism stuff. You know? She loved her grandparents and her parents and her aunts and uncles and her cousins. Because they were separated, sometimes they were more together. Like, they all went to public schools, but they had to watch out for each other. She had a cousin who was, they weren't supposed to have boyfriends, and her cousin kept having secret boyfriends. You know, that's the same cousin that ends up marrying the guy from England, by the way. They found her a man.
Mm-hmm.
And she's very staunchly into it. Like, she always hopes her cousin's going to leave and all this. She planned her cousin's wedding to that guy from England. She was very much an organizer and a worker in the church, but these people talked her out of it. The thing I was going to say is, culturally, you would think they would separate them and be like, oh, y'all can't watch R-rated movies or listen to this music or that. No, her and her sisters would, like, quote raunchy rap lyrics at each other and stuff. They were completely allowed to watch and view anything. They believed all that was they're all the people are going to hell anyway. It doesn't matter. They're not going to corrupt us. We're elect.
Right.
So they had no restrictions on any of that. And doesn't that seem weird? Like, you would just assume.
Yeah, considering some of the things that I've read of theirs, that is strange.
Yeah, they had no restrictions like that at all. When they were younger, they had no modesty restrictions. Except for in church, they had to cover their hair. So they wore something over their head in church. But when they were younger, you'll watch the videos and things of them. You'll see them in things normal American people would be in, tank tops and skirts and shorts and things. Later, when the elders took over, they had modesty things enacted, and they weren't allowed to show their shoulders or their anything beyond their wrist and stuff like that. But in the but earlier on, for most of her childhood, that wasn't the case at all. So it's very interesting how they applied super strict things on some stuff, but not on others.
Yeah.
She had her own car. She could come and go. It wasn't like, oh, she had to check out of the compound. There was no compound. It was their family house, just like any 20-something-year-old girl that lives at home. She had a job. She went to college. You know? When they left, they're ostracized and leave, but her dad rented them a U-Haul truck and let them load up everything from their bedrooms. It wasn't like they had to leave under night and the security guards chased them out.
Right.
She got to go say goodbye to everybody. Yeah. But at the same time, they will never talk to her again. And when she goes to their house and knocks on the door, they turn out the lights. So I would encourage the listeners to go look up that Megan Phillips-Roper and look at her TED Talks and her talks. I pray for her that she does come to a faithful knowledge of Jesus, because I think that could be helpful for everybody. That saddens me. I understand her pain and where it's hard for that. But mm-hmm. she's obviously seen the error of the hate. And
right.
Has even visited. There's a story in her book where after she got out, not very long after she got out, she went and visited a, they also hate Jews, by the way. They don't have a problem mm-hmm. with black people, but they hate Jews. She went and visited a Holocaust museum thing in, I think, Los Angeles. And they have an exhibit on her family. And her sister visited there. And like, oh, yeah, hey, there's cousin so-and-so. And there's little so-and-so when they were a baby. And there's, you know, because they have an exhibit on her family there. And that being wow. there and seeing that and being able to process that was really difficult. And the other thing is the experience she's had is that people that she used to hate so much are now not hateful to her.
Right. That's a, I, you know, looking at their beliefs and the things that they've written, I wouldn't, I don't know, the experiences that she had on the ground don't necessarily seem to align with how they portray themselves in their texts.
Oh, absolutely. That's the point she makes, is that she was mm-hmm. raised almost as a normal little girl, except for the daily pickets, right? But otherwise, mm-hmm. she was a normal little girl who played with her siblings and watched TV and went to school and all this. Another one of those weird things. When she was in high school, at lunchtime, her and her cousins, instead of eating lunch, would go outside and pick up picket signs and picket outside their school and tell all their classmates they're going to hell, that God hates them. And then after lunch was over, they'd put their picket signs down, go back inside, and go back to class.
Oh,
and then wonder why they had no friends.
Yeah.
They didn't wonder. They knew why they had no friends. At her own high school graduation, she walked and accepted her diploma thing, then had to go outside, join her family to picket the graduation.
Oh.
This just...
Really?
The paradoxes of this duality, this back and forth stuff, you know. Same thing when she graduated college. She walked and then went outside to picket the college graduation, not by herself but with her whole family, you know.
Right.
And I'm assuming the same thing happened for her brothers and sisters and cousins. Like, this was just
probably
life
to so.
Them, you know, she has fond memories of her dad and her mom and her aunts and uncles and. Different stuff. So, anyways, I think we pretty much have covered the history there.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that puts us on a good trajectory to talk about what they actually teach. You know, the publications and things that they've got out there to propagate some of their theology and their teachings. So I think that gives us a good stopping point for this episode. So join us next week as we dig into the theology and doctrines of Westboro Baptist Church. Thank you for joining us here on Faith, Frauds, and Falsehoods. Don't forget that we have our website, faithfraudsfalsehoods.com, where we post a more detailed blog with references so that you can go and take a look at all of this information for yourself. Also, remember to share this with a friend and help us get the word out there for everyone else. We'll see you in the next one.